Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
I would like you to think back to about this time in 2018. We were 2 months away from legalized recreational marijuana, and it seemed like the entire country was planning to get rich.
Canada's pot industry, it's worth anywhere between $4 and $12 billion. The global pot market, we're told, could be worth as much as $40 billion.
Well, I'd say this is a very real industry with a real market. We are going to have dominant multinational companies, and most likely several of those will be Canadians.
Cannabis companies were some of the hottest stocks on the market. One of those rare investment opportunities that goes mainstream among people who don't usually have a broker. And if there was any worry back then, it was about supply. Now think of the first few weeks after pot became legal. Do you remember the lineups outside the few physical stores that existed, the ones that stretched around the block? People were wondering if growers could keep up with demand. Well, let's just say that it turned out they absolutely could. In fact, less than 3 years after pot became legal in this country, there are hundreds of millions of grams of marijuana going stale on shelves or being destroyed because they've gone bad. So if you were deep into the cannabis stocks back then, I hope you got out at the right time. If you left your job for a cool new position at a weed company, I sincerely hope you're still there, but it's likely you are not. What happened to this supposedly lucrative market? What happened to the companies that bet so heavily on Canadians buying their product? What happened to all those pot smokers that to this day have still never set foot in a legal retail store? How can one of the world's most popular substances be such a tough business? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Kieran Delamont is a writer and reporter based in Nova Scotia who investigated the state of Canada's legal pot industry for The Walrus. Hey, Kieran.
Hi.
Why don't you do what your piece does so well and take me back for a minute to right before legalization in Canada. What was happening in the industry? It's almost hard to remember now.
So legalization, the legal industry that we think of as, I guess, as a recreational industry really comes out of the medical industry and the medical cannabis space. And that in 2012 was essentially privatized into a series of large industrial producers. Some of the first ones that you might remember, Tweed, Aurora, Tilray, Bedrocan.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of these companies got their start in 2012 when the Harper government wanted to open up the market to companies which meet strict security requirements. And they did this because I don't think they really had a great deal of an interest in running a medical cannabis industry. Medical cannabis being legal goes back as far as 2001 when it was made legal through some court challenges. And the government was not very good at running an industry. It was called the MMAR system. And it was really sort of mainly aimed at regulating which situations cannabis could be used in and all these sorts of exceptions. And so what they did in 2012 was to create these large producers. That's, I guess, sort of where it starts. And these companies are sort of crucially open for investment. And so they start opening up to retail investors. And Tweed, through a reverse takeover of a shell corporation, lands themselves on the Toronto Stock Exchange. And that opens up this new avenue to sort of say, hey, we can come in and bring retail investors and we can bring large institutional investors. And it was very much this period where money could kind of come in. Basically, so from the time that legalization sort of came under the radar in 2015, 2016 with the Liberal election, it was really a matter of like, can we get enough investment money into this industry to be able to produce enough cannabis to supply the legal industry that they were expecting.
Why was the legal pot industry seen as, you know, a guaranteed moneymaker? Why was it so hot back then? And now I'm talking about the period between when the liberals were elected and when pot actually became recreationally legal. Like, that was an insane trajectory for all those stocks.
In part, I think it's because nobody had any kind of idea what to expect. We had no metrics for what a national legal industry was going to look like. It was 2015, 2016. And so even the experiments down in the United States that we sort of most closely compare ourselves to in terms of Colorado and Oregon and Washington, all of whom had legalized sort of in the year or two before the liberals came into power, 2014, 2015, they were starting legal industries. And nobody really knew exactly what a national industry was going to look like and how that was going to be able to function. And, you know, the thing it was sort of talked about and thought about was really this kind of license to print money. And it follows from, I think, that sort of logic that any kind of vice substance is easy to sell and that people are going to want it. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's like Canada was one of the highest pot consuming countries in the world per capita. And, you know, we just sort of have a culture, whether that's, you know, the sort of the 1990s thing of like BC Bud or you know, the Vancouver culture or many of the sort of underground dispensaries in Toronto, like it was mm-hmm. socially acceptable here. We had a sort of a thriving industry and the industry was working. And so I think the idea was that we would be able to take that industry and legalize it. And there would be no hitches in that. It was really just going to be a matter of getting people into the stores and getting people to buy the product. And, you know, I think that they didn't anticipate some of the hiccups that they ended up running into. But so about 2016, in between 2016 and 2018, it was, you know, and investors were really sort of buying into this and they could see that companies would have all of this production capacity. So if you could say that you were going to produce X amount of cannabis per year, that was very exciting to investors because I think right. the assumption was that it was going to have a stable price. It was going to have a price that could be bought and sold like a commodity, sort of like tomatoes, and that we wouldn't see production problems for the one thing, that we wouldn't see sort of hiccups in terms of learning how to produce cannabis at these kind of massive scales where it had never really been tried. I think that they thought that this was going to be a much smoother process than it was. And then from there, they began to sort of think that investing in cannabis production was essentially guaranteed to bring in revenues like that.
And it's tough to remember now, but it wasn't just big investment groups buying into this, right? Like, this was retail investment down to ordinary Canadians who were telling each other, like, get on board. This is going to go crazy.
Yeah. And companies were sort of actively courting those sorts of investments. And I remember they were called sort of weed stocks. And the Reddit for weed stocks became this kind of hub for, you know, which companies can I put my money in? And people were seeing really crazy returns, right? Like, they were investing little bits of money and seeing these things go, you know, 10 times, 100 times, and making these sorts of fortunes on it.
Right.
And that sort of reinforces itself, right? If you hear enough stories of that, it's like people want to jump in and people keep throwing money into this industry. And then having a large number of retail investors like that is very attractive to kind of big capital organizations that want to dump more money into these companies and really large, gargantuan amounts of money into these companies. Seeing that it had kind of a very, it made it very palatable to them to see such strong retail interest. And retail interest, I think, you know, could have inferred some kind of consumer interest as well.
So pot becomes legal in October of that year of 2018. And what happens then? And I guess we can get into the hiccups a little bit. But what I'm most interested in is, how long did it take to become clear that this was not perhaps going to be the license to print money that everybody was expecting?
It's hard to say when that, I think that impression starts to set in. 2018 comes around and what we have is still shortages. Because of the sort of the rapid scale up of this industry and the rapid way we legalized it, you know, we were still having stores that didn't have enough product and we were still seeing, if you can recall, the lineups outside of stores in Quebec for empty shelves. We didn't have enough, right? And it was, you know, in 2018, this was very much the pressing problem, was to say, how can we supply this industry fast enough so it seems legitimate, fast enough that people will buy in, and fast enough that we don't run into, like, the sight of empty stores and the sight of lineups for, you know, for empty shelves, essentially. And it's they are going to pump more money in because production is what is needed at that point. And Health Canada sort of steps in and say, we are going to fast track anybody with a built facility up to the front of the line for an approval. Because even at that point, there was a lot of people taking a lot of time in with the authorization process on facilities that not had it built. They might have had financing, but they hadn't been built yet. Or they maybe in some cases didn't even entirely have financing trying to get these authorizations, these licenses. And so they start to contribute to this problem. And so money just kind of keeps going and it keeps being turned into these industrial grow ops. And, you know, these are scaling up and these are doing these massive grows and they're still trying to sort of supply the market. And then sometime kind of around late 2019, 2020, we start to get into oversupply. And part of that is because the legal market is not catching on with consumers the way that they expected and sales are sort of staying not quite as high as they would have wanted. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is it's just there's a lot of players in this game at this point. Throughout all of this from about 2016 through 2017 through 2018, even through 2019, Health Canada is still approving more producers. They are approving more facilities. They are, you know, continuing to sort of push product into this sort of supply equation. You know, the oversupply, I think, was a moment when everyone looked at it and go, okay, maybe not, right? Maybe there is some sort of things that we need to do.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
Can you quantify that a little bit for us? You know, what percentage of the market is legal pot? And when you talk about oversupply, how much pot sitting around are we talking about?
So the oversupply we're talking about, I checked in today. They do keep stats that are a couple, you know, sort of a couple months old, but it's still up around a million kilograms or a billion grams, which is slightly a dramatic way of putting the number. But a billion grams of cannabis is in either in this process of drying and curing or is sitting as, you know, finished but unpackaged. There's plenty that's still in packages that they can't sell. It's a lot, and it's a glut, and it's more than I think that it's more than the legal market sells in a year. It outpaces demand by a significant chunk, and we're still adding more all the time. Production was up in the first couple months of 2021. They are still pushing more production into the pipeline, and the big one that really got us to this billion gram mark was outdoor grows, and these were initially not allowed. And then in 2019, there was a couple grows outdoor, largely a kind of a first run at it because there was lots of trouble. People were not necessarily totally adept at it quite yet, and the harvests were pretty low that year. 2020, and maybe this is because of the pandemic and there was nobody out and everyone had a green thumb, the amount that they were able to harvest in around September, October, November of last year was huge. And that's what really pushes us over this kind of billion gram mark and into this sort of point where, you know, everyone's looking around going, like, what can we do with this? And so much of it is sitting there also, you know, growing less and less attractive by the day. It's drying out.
Right.
The chemicals inside of it are degrading. The cannabinoids are degrading. The quality is degrading. And you see tons of it being destroyed every year because it's unsellable. And keeping it in, you know, on the balance sheet is maybe not the greatest way to do it. And then, so to answer your first question, I think, you know, we are probably at around about 50%, maybe a little bit north of 50% now in terms of the legal market and the illegal market.
That seems unreasonably low to a layperson. You know, we're 3 years in here.
Yeah, it seems low, but I guess I do not necessarily find it surprising that it's low.
Why not?
I think from the get-go, and if there really is, you know, sort of an original kind of fatal flaw in the system, it's the cannabis industry was sort of set up to really consolidate a lot of the money and a lot of the control into the hands of capital and into the hands of business elite. And you see people like Julian Fantino and police officers getting into it and being able to cash in. And, mm-hmm. you know, it was really set up as an industry that favored business interests, that favored corporate interests. And their interest is, and that's where it is. It's cannabis was commodified right from the get-go, right? You've gone from an industry that was guided from by communities of cannabis users and communities of dealers and growers and sellers and buyers, and it was all very amorphous, to one that was guided first and foremost by interest of capital and financial interests, and their hope was to make money on it. And I think at a basic kind of level, the plant does not necessarily respond well to industrial scale growing. And I don't think we knew that before we were doing it at the scale that we're doing it now. It introduces problems. You have problems with pests. You have problems with poor quality. It's not easy to grow it in a large, regulated, technological facility in the way that we thought it was. But, you know, that is also just, it can be alienating. And you know, a lot of people that have resisted joining and kind of coming into this legal market, it's the price is too high, for one thing. The quality is too low. You know, you can get better stuff from your dealer on the street. You can get better stuff from these unregulated dispensaries. You can get them from the mail order. It's we still have a very thriving legacy market. You know, if that is still doing well and if that is still servicing people's needs, then what incentive do they have to switch over? Right? If I buy from a legal dispensary and I just chuck it in a glass mason jar, you know, as far as anybody knows, that's the same stuff. There's no way to differentiate it. And so because there's no way to differentiate it, there's really no way to also sort of police it on people.
So what's happened then to these large companies who were kind of the first in to the legal market and were valued so highly and invested in so much?
They have continued to lose money at really rapid clips. I think the figure we calculated within just about 5 or 6 of the biggest companies, your Canopies, your Tilray's, Aurora, Aphria, you know, if you look at their losses in the last 4 or 5 years, we're north of $10 billion.
Wow.
Canopy Growth itself has lost nearly $4 billion in, you know, the last 4 or 5 years. Other companies, you know, the losses still, they mount up in towards $2 billion. And, you know, they have sort of, I think, survived because some of them have very large institutional investors. I mean, with Canopy, you know, they were the first in, attracted some of the biggest investment for a time with the biggest company, the highest market cap. And, you know, I'm not sure that they've really ever consistently turned any kind of profit. And I don't know what the runway is for these companies. I don't know how long that they can sustain those kinds of losses. All of them had predicted that they were going to have losses. All of them knew that there was going to be a few years where they were going to be in the red consistently. I don't think that they thought it was going to be this long. I don't think that they thought that the losses were going to be this deep. And I think that they expected that by now they would be able to see a pathway out of losses and into being profitable. And I don't think a lot of them are looking at it right now with much of an idea how exactly to get there. So you see in recent earnings calls, you know, Canopy saying we're just not where we expected to be. We're not where we wanted to be. And that, you know, and I think that's interesting because right now the government and the industry are both undertaking reviews. They have to start a review within 3 years of the legalization date. And so that's going to start to take a look at things like the medical industry and like the home growing rules and all of these sorts of ways that they're approaching the cannabis industry. It's going to sort of take into consideration how can we try to further suppress the legacy market? How can we try to further shift people in? And I'm very curious to see what comes out of that. I quote one industry representative, Ryan Greer, in the piece, and his take was that they just want, it's like, it's regulatory burden, right? It's the, you know, they want to see fewer regulations on themselves. They want to see more of an ability to be more flexible and dynamic and all of these things. And, you know, I'm not necessarily sure whether that's going to be the ticket, but that's what they would like to see. But then there's, you know, I think there are other things, there are bigger conversations that we're going to have about whether the industry wants to allow home growing, whether the industry is, you know, going to look and from a financial perspective, be willing to allow home growing to kind of continue to proliferate. I think a very significant thing happened early in the spring Health Canada, in sort of preparation for this, circulates a draft guidance document, and that for the very first time sets out factors that they could use to revoke someone's personal home growing registration. And that's interesting. You know, this whole industry started way back in 2001. The medical industry started with people growing at home and people having their own little grow ups to supply,
right,
you know, themselves with their medicine and to supply other people with medicine. And now they're sort of talking about sort of taking a harsher approach to that based on, you know, largely unfounded claims that it's supplying organized crime, that it's like being diverted out of the legal market. And, you know, a lot of these claims are sort of made without really kind of a clear idea of like what that exactly means. But, you know, we could see something like home growing clamp down. And on the other side, you've seen the industry also call for harsher police enforcement on unregulated dispensaries and mail order dispensaries. And it's, which is sort of ironic because a lot of their talent, a lot of their labor force has come up through the unregulated market over the years. So I think you're sort of reaching an inflection point as we sort of go forward that will be interesting to see how some of these decisions shake out.
The last question I want to ask while we have you here, because it's still on my mind, is, are we sure there is a path to sustainability for a legal industry nationally of this size? Is there a way to make sure that it works, or are we kind of still in uncharted territory?
I think that's a tougher question to answer. So experts will, I think if you talk to experts, I think they still believe sort of deep down that there is a profitable way to do this. And whether that is, you know, partly removing some of these high costs, you know, in terms of regulations and things like that, I think that could be one thing. So one thing I sort of didn't really necessarily get to touch on too much in the piece is that I think there's still a lot of excitement around this idea of craft growing, of grows that fit into the Health Canada's micro-cultivation category. And there are size limits to this, but it's generally smaller operations. But the costs are still huge. It's you know, people say it's between $1 and $2 million to get a license and to get a facility and to get all these clearances and registrations. And that's, you know, that's not a sustainable way to get people into the industry. On the other hand, you know, if we talk about, if we try to sort of cast ourselves into the future and think about what a profitable industry is going to look like and a sustainable industry and one that is not running into problems, I think it's just going to be a smaller one. I don't think that an industry set up with financial interests and led by capital really and sort of existing under the pressure of capital all the time is going to be able to turn profits, at least in the current environment, sort of consistently. I think that we're going to have to look at something a little bit more decentralized and a little bit more less regulated, a little bit less controlled by sort of this heavy central hand of Health Canada. Because I think that it's just the costs associated with doing it are so high and the results are sort of so lackluster for a lot of people that is not a model that I think that if you were to do it now, you would try to replicate, right? If you were legalizing now, I don't think you would look to the way we've done it with big industrial producers and say, this is a proven model. This is one that's going to work. Mm-hmm. Sort of time and time again, the things that they've said were going to work, like, didn't. You know, in 2018, when the companies weren't turning profits, it was like, well, it's going to be, well, let's wait until edibles become legal.
Right.
That's going to be, you know, cannabis 2.0 is going to be the savior. And then cannabis 2.0 has come along and it hasn't been the savior for people. I'm fairly sympathetic to someone like Tim Barnhart and the Indigenous cannabis movement who are, you know, staking out this sovereign little industry for themselves. And they're doing it in a very simple kind of way, right? It's often, it's they're growing it on their own land and they're selling it to their own people and people passing through. And I think it's all small enough and it's all, it seems authentic enough and it's all sustainable enough, the costs are low, that they can sort of make it work. And I know that there's going to be a lot of people both in government and in the industry and elsewhere who think that they're, you know, taking advantage of basically the fact that cops aren't going to come in and necessarily bust them up, but I think it works well. And I think it works well at a scale that's comfortable. And so if we could think about how we replicate that, you know, throughout the Indigenous cannabis sort of industry operates in part because there's not all that much appetite to stop it. But can we think about, you know, what lessons can we take from that in terms of of expanding that to a legal market outside? I think those are interesting questions. And so out here in Nova Scotia, there was an article a couple months ago about micro growers and craft growers who were trying to sort of get cleared to sell it at farmers markets. Mm. And I think that's an interesting thing to think about too, right? If we're willing to just sort of say, we're willing to kind of to loosen the grip of the regulator just a titch and to say, you know, we can let people sell what they're growing. We can let people, you know, have a small little grow up and sell the proceeds on the side to sort of either supplement their income or to try to make a run at a sustainable business. I think finding ways to empower people to do it that way is good. And I think a big part of that is if you succeed in doing that, I think it will resonate with your target customers. You know, this is in some sense a business piece that I was writing, but undergirding all of it is that there's a basic cultural mismatch here, and which is that the people who buy the most cannabis and use the most cannabis are not feeling at home in this industry. They don't really love going into that kind of like very highly designed kind of store. The dispensaries that you've seen, oftentimes they're chains. They don't love it. They don't love the high prices. They don't love all of the restrictions in terms of quantities that you can buy. Mm-hmm. They especially do not love the edible dose strength limits, potency limits. They don't, you know, it doesn't match the way people who are cannabis users interact with the plant. You know, that's a much more intractable problem, is how do you make a government regulated industry and one that is led by sort of business and financial interests? How do you match that to an industry that was, or a community that was circulating and supplying and growing and selling cannabis pretty sustainably before legalization ever showed up?
It'll be fascinating to watch where this goes over the next several months. Thank you, Kieran, for coming on the show today.
Oh, you're welcome.
Kieran Delamont, writing for The Walrus. That was The Big Story. For more from us, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. We are still taking election suggestions from you. What do you want to hear about? What issues do you need covered? Let us know there on Twitter or, of course, at TheBigStoryPodcast@rci.rogers.com. You can find us in any and all podcast players. You can like us, you can rate us, you can review us. But it's better to go offline and tell your friends. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.